Welcome to this episode of the Bonding with ASI podcast. I'm Susan Sutton, editor of Adhesives and Sealants Industry, and I'm joined today by George Ritter, who's a director with the ChemQuest Group and the ChemQuest Technology Institute. Hi, George. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to have the opportunity.
George recently authored a column focused on testing protocols for structural adhesives, and that's what we're going to be discussing today. George, what are some of the factors that need to be considered when determining the best test to run for a specific structural adhesive application?
First of all, there's quite a forest of opportunities out there when it comes to testing, and there are just hundreds of tests. And so what we have to do is establish what I refer to as a testing protocol. We have to decide which tests we need to get the information we want to feel confident about what we're doing. So philosophy, the adhesive is part of a bonded mechanical system. So we want to assure ourselves that that system will perform adequately under all the anticipated conditions. We want the system to manage the necessary loads, and we want it to be reliable under all the circumstances we can imagine. So we want our testing protocol to encompass things like temperature extremes, humidity exposure, chemical exposure, or other environmental issues that may happen. And we also want to be able to look at, are there effects of surface preparation or adhesive selection or adhesive cure? So it gets complex quickly. And what we really want to do is cut through all that and get to a list of tests that will help us determine what we need to know. We also need to consider that the adhesive is part of a system, so we want the system to use the adhesive in the best way. We have to consider, as I mentioned, surface preparations for good adhesion, but we want to use a joint design that, if possible, puts the adhesive into compressive load or shear load, but we want to avoid peel loading whenever possible. And the reason for that is adhesives don't work very well in peel. They work very well in shear, and very well in compression, but we want to try to avoid peel loading. So the joint design also factors into the kinds of tests we do and how we run them. So many of these, all these factors will go into designing a test protocol.
How can modeling make the design process more efficient in terms of sample numbers and developmental costs?
Okay, modeling has really advanced significantly in the last 10 to 15 years, and not all companies have it or even have access to it, which is an issue, but modeling gives us a predictable performance characteristics, including where we've made allowances for extremes of environmental exposure. So when we look at some of the economics and what's involved in getting the data we want, the traditional study may involve hundreds or even thousands, if you believe it, of discrete samples. And these would be exposed to the many different conditions, different surface preparations, different adhesive combinations, and we have to test these in multiples. Sometimes we usually do at least 5 or 7, and for final numbers, you may do 25 samples to get statistical basis under each condition. It really grows in like topsy in a hurry. And then in the end, what we have is all these snapshots of different areas or of where we're trying to operate. It still doesn't tell us how the system is going to function. It tells us how the adhesive is going to function. And the other part too is all of these samples, they're expensive to make. They're expensive to test one by one. And the materials that go into these samples may be quite expensive or even difficult to obtain. And in the end, they're all going to get thrown away. They're going to get broken. I mean, some may be saved for evidentiary purposes, or you take a lot of pictures or something like that. But in the end, when you're done, all this stuff is going to get thrown away. And it can be very expensive to do it that way. Now, with a model, first of all, you get the information about the entire system. You're not only entering information about the adhesive, and I'll come back to that, but you're also entering information about what it's holding together. And so, for example, with, you know, I may model a car door joint. Well, if I'd have the whole door, I have a model of the whole door, not just the adhesive joint down around the edges or something like that. So we do need to make some samples for the modeling, but typically there are far fewer of them. And even in some cases, they may be more complex and more difficult to make, but there are far fewer of them. And so I had an example once, we did a project where I had, before we had modeling, we made over 1500 samples, and they were expensive. They all used advanced composites and things like that. We had 1500 samples. Just 3 years later with modeling, we had the same kind of thing we were approaching, and we made about 160 samples. So it's really, you know, a tenfold difference can be, and we probably these days we could have made 50 or 40 or something like that. So all that engineering data then goes into the model, and as I said, we can begin to predict the performance of the entire system, including, you know, we've thrown in some discrete tests already on environmental exposure. The other part is we can go outside the envelope, so to speak. We have the model now, so we can go outside the envelope and we look at areas we didn't anticipate looking at. So it's very useful that way. And finally, when we have all this model and we have all our predictions, we can go back and build some test samples to validate the model. But some of these might even be full size. Let me go back, you know, before we had all these 100, let's go back to the car door example. Before we had all these hundreds and hundreds of samples that we broke in, and we still didn't know how our car door worked. Well, now with the modeling, we go back, maybe we build five car doors or three, and we can expose them to this, that, or the other and rip them apart, and we have our validation. So the cost and the effort and the testing time are greatly reduced. You have modeling time, of course, but it's a much better way of getting more and better predictability about the system. And in the end, it can be quite a bit less expensive if you can have the modeling capabilities.
You mentioned the importance of shear testing. Can you explain why a double lap shear test gives better adhesive information than a single lap shear test? Is it okay to use a single lap shear test for certain circumstances?
Yes, and I'll speak to that. The issue of double versus single lap has to do with some of the mechanics of the test joint itself, which I'll explain here in talking about the single lap shear. I think in the article, you know, we're a little restrained in word count, so I may have given single laps kind of a bad rep, but in fact, the single lap shear sample is the most commonly made sample used as far as shear testing. And it's because it's so easy. You just take two pieces of something and overlap them in what becomes the middle. Usually it's a half inch depth or maybe 1 inch depth, and there you have it. You can make it in sheets, or you can make them one at a time. The issue is when you go to test the sample, typically you put it in a tensile tester and you start to pull, that the joint itself can begin to twist in the center. Because it's asymmetrical. One side is off to the side of the other side, so to speak, and it's asymmetrical with the adhesive in the middle. But we'll get to some tricks to get around that. But they are very good. They're simple, they're cheap. You can use them for screening purposes, for surface preparations, adhesive selection, temperature, humidity, on and on. You can use these simple, cheap samples to get basic information and then go back and build better samples to get the information you need, for example, for modeling. Now, as far as this twisting motion in the center with a single lap, there are a couple really easy things you can do. One's very easy, the one a little less easy. You can shim on opposite sides of the joint with another thickness of material, and then when you clamp those, and those shims don't have to be bonded. You clamp it in. It won't allow for the adhesive thickness, but you bring it up close to, but not exact, not not touching the actual joint, and then that can remove a lot of the peel moldment. It's very simple, and you use the shims over and over and over for many, many tests. Another thing you do is a little more complex. You actually bond the two strips together for the entire length of the sample, which is usually about 7 or 8 inches, up to 200 millimeters, whatever. And then you mark the center and you go a quarter inch, say, to the left of the center on the top, and you machine a notch. And then you turn it over and you go a quarter inch to the right of the center on the bottom, and you machine a notch. And so now you have a single lap shear sample with the half inch overlap or 1 inch, whatever it is you're going to use. And you have then this completely bonded in between area in between, and that greatly reduces the peel moment. So it's a little more complex. The nice thing about that kind of sample is you can actually go ahead and bond two sheets together, then trim scrap, and you could machine the notch all the way across and all the way across, but typically the way it's done is go ahead and dice up that sheet into your individual test specimens and then machine in the notches. A double lap specimen, there are a couple of tricks to that, and they're more complex, but the simplest way to describe a double lap specimen is if you took two single lap specimens and then buttered them edge to edge with the center and then the two wings, if you will, sticking down the sides. And the site complexity to that is that centerpiece that's sticking out should be twice the thickness of the wings, if you will. I'll call that the tongue and the wings. So the tongue needs to be twice the thickness of the wings. And then you have an adhesive bond on either side of the tongue, which bonds on the wings. You can typically also then you bond in a shim down the wings someplace. You bond in a shim also of the 2T thickness. So, and then you have completely symmetrical sample. And the beauty of that then is when you pull on that, you do that in shear or in tensile or compression, push on it in compression, you have a complete center line of thrust. And so there is no peel moment. It's very greatly reduced. And from that, you can get genuine engineering data, for example, to use in a model. There's another version, what I described to you mentally there is called the type A. There's another version called the type B. And in this case, you take two pieces of your two thickness, what used to be the tongue, and you butt the two tongues up together with a little spacer in between. And then you use a single thickness doubler top and bottom over the center. And so now you have sort of a sandwich with the two tongues sticking out and the two doublers on the top and the bottom all bonded together and so on with that spacer in the middle. And then those two are very easy to make up in plates and slice and dice. But the bottom line is that a double lap shear sample gives you true engineering data that you can use in modeling. And so you can use single laps to get the basics and then use double laps if you're gonna go into a modeling situation.
Okay. How are structural bonds typically evaluated for environmental issues?
Unfortunately, the only thing to do is to treat them badly. And so, we have to expose them to environmental conditions under controlled circumstances. The most common ones are probably extremes in temperature. And that you store the samples at a given a high or low temperature for a period of time using either ovens or freezers. And how long, that's always a good question. There may be specifications that talk about a specific time. Frequently, those exposures are at least days or into weeks, in some cases months, but rarely, but at least days or some period of time. Because the idea is you want to sort of age the adhesive and see what the bonds do over time. So you can also cycle temperature. That requires usually some more sophisticated equipment in terms of temperature controls. And there are boxes you can buy that do both hot and cold, and they'll cycle between hot and cold, and those get fairly sophisticated. What most people do is they'll go ahead and put something in the oven, a stack of samples in the oven for whatever it is, and then they'll just mechanically take them out of the oven and put them into a freezer for some period of time, and then just somebody comes in over the weekend and switches the samples and all that sort of thing. Humidity is really very easy to mimic. The thing about humidity is, believe it or not, exposure to water vapor is far more aggressive than exposure to water. So some people, you know, they'll soak samples in a tub. Well, actually water itself is not very efficient at getting into joints and causing trouble, but vapor is. So usually with humidity, we have some sort of source of vapor. And it can be very simple. There can be steam cabinets. You can use a crock pot, you kind of thermostat it. You buy a little box with a thermostat, stick it down in the crock pot and set it on low or high or whatever, and puddle of water in the bottom with a tray. You can do it that way. And there are typically some temperatures that are specced out, 120 or 140, 180 F, or as the rest of the world would say, 50, 60, or 82 C. I've seen people in electronics companies, which is really just torturous, they'll put a finished circuit board into a pressure cooker and leave it for 24 hours. And if that doesn't tell you what's wrong, nothing will. So they take the samples out whenever you're done. You can test them at room temperature, or you can just test them, you know, right out of the oven or right out of the freezer, or right out of the crock pot or whatever it is. And all these things can be combined into cycles. And that's frequently done, particularly in the automotive and aerospace. We have hot with humidity, and then you have dry, and then you have cold, and so on and so forth. And you combine all these cycles. That's particularly the case in corrosion testing, where in corrosion testing, the drying portion of the cycle is very important. Drying out a sample actually increases the chances of corrosion progression. And I'm getting all the details as to why that out is, but then these samples can be quite complex. The bad part of it is, finally, is that it takes time. It's calendar time. And, you know, if something's got to soak for 3 weeks, it's got to soak for 3 weeks. And that's all there is to it. So there's a lot of calendar time involved. And typically we want to have these kinds of information as well if we're going to be doing modeling. And so there's still that built-in time lag. Maybe you get started on your model while you're waiting to get these data back. But the good point is, when you're done, whether you're using modeling or discrete samples, you have a much more confidence in the durability of your system and the reliability of your model over extremes. So basically humidity, temperature, sometimes salt exposure, I left that out, salt fog, that sort of thing, and infinite combinations thereof, and variety of cycles.
Do companies need to run their own tests, particularly since it seems like a lot of these are very involved, or do they need to run tests that maybe they don't want to run?
You don't have to run your own tests. And again, that's an internal decision, depending on where you are and how often you think you're going to be doing these things. There's certainly testing labs for hire that will work with you in developing the test protocols and then run the tests. This is done for a fee. The fee may be based, sometimes it's a straight per sample charge. So you send them 200 lap shears and a lap shear costs you X, and they charge you 200X to test your 200 lap shears or whatever it is. It may also be determined on a time materials basis. And that would be more the case if you're asking the testing lab to make the samples and buy the materials and build the samples and machine them and all that. And then they would quote you on a time materials basis. You mentioned in the beginning that ChemQuest has our subsidiary, ChemQuest Technology Institute. And we do that sort of thing. We develop test protocols and execute the tests to whatever extent of integration it needs to, if you have to buy the stuff and make the stuff or just run the tests or whatever. But, and there are others, you can find others that will do this. As far as running tests you don't want to, the way I interpret that is, this is when you're working against a tight specification. Could be automotive, could be aerospace, could be FDA certification. And there are certain tests that they want you to run that are really very complex and time consuming, and the samples are difficult and expensive to make and so on. And in those cases, if you don't want to gear up to run those tests, and you're not going to run them on a regular basis, again, you can go outside to specialty houses, and there are places that specialize in doing automotive testing or aerospace testing, especially FDA compliance. And in the case of FDA compliance, it may do you well to just plan to go outside, because you're going to get a third party blind justice analysis of your product with all the data and all the information and everything. And you know, it's certified to FDA compliance lab, and you're going to get data that is much more presentable, if you will, to an agency like the FDA. The thing to remember about any testing is your business is you're manufacturing a device or a component. You're not in the adhesives business. You're not in the testing business. You're trying to produce a product. And that's the business you're in. So you don't want necessarily to be an adhesive testing facility. You just want to use adhesives in your product. So it can be economical to go outside every time and go to a test lab and have them perform all that work for you, just so you have the confidence you need to produce the product you want to. And it may be even on economic, it may be economical even on a repetitive basis to just, you know, push that outside, let someone else do it. In the meantime, you're establishing a good relationship with your testing facility. You're probably going to use them again. They know you, you know them, they understand your business, and you know how they work. So sometimes it can be better to just plan to go outside to get these tests run rather than to figure it out, bring it in-house.
I could imagine that some companies might be discouraged with testing because they think they need to buy a lot of equipment for their tests, and other companies might actually expect their adhesive suppliers to simply run these tests for them as part of, you know, a technical service agreement or something like that. What's the reality? What actually is happening?
Let me start with the last part first. And this follows on the last question as well. Adhesive suppliers may be willing to run some tests for you, but often that is not the case. There are several factors that may determine whether or not they'd be willing to do that. But to be fair, their technical service staff is there to help you pick the right adhesive and to help you to achieve a successful application. So they'll give advice and they'll give product recommendations, and they may provide adhesive samples. Frequently when they give product recommendations, though, they may suggest several samples that you need to work with them and try and pick from. The other thing too about sampling is it's frequently handled through distributors. That's because these are small quantities, and typically the distributor is only going to stock a material that they sell regularly. And lots of adhesive companies have many, many products that they don't produce great quantities of. They're capable of doing it, but they're definitely specialty products. So usually, if you're working with a distributor, you're going to have to buy the samples. Or you're going to have to buy the adhesive. And they're in small tubes or cartridges or whatever it is. But typically, they're going to require, you know, the distributor is going to sell you the samples. If you're dealing directly with the adhesive supplier, And particularly if it's a material that they don't stock or offer through distributors and it is a specialty item, you're probably going to have to pay for that sample too. And here's the reason why. They're going to have to go into the lab and make you your sample. It may be, you know, a few hundred grams or pound or something or other. Then they have to QC it. They have to test it. They have to certify. They have to go through a lot there. It's not going to slot this stuff into a quart can and ship it off. And so there's a fair amount of expense to them to preparing small samples on request. And it doesn't guarantee you're going to buy their product. And so let's be fair. So they will help you as much as they can to try and select one of their products. But for the most part, they don't get into that involved in testing. And you may have to pay a fee or just buy outright from a distributor adhesive samples. So as for the equipment, now that was a long answer to a short question. As for the equipment, if you're going to be doing a lot of routine adhesive work, the fundamental piece of equipment is some type of tensile tester. And there are many, many different kinds on the market. It's a good investment. I can't quote prices anymore, and I wouldn't anyway. But the other thing, too, is all of them you can add on. So you can start with a basic tester, and you can add different jaws or hot boxes or cold boxes or other types of fixtures for running different kinds of tests, peel, compression, tensile, shear. Most of them now come with really good software. And they do curve generation. You get much more information than you used to be able to get by hand, and you don't have to do it by hand. It just happens. So most of the tensile testers really enable you to go paperless. If your security allows it, you can store your data on the cloud and go direct to the cloud, whatever. It takes advantage of all those little modern possibilities. How big? Well, tensile testers can range in size from systems that will handle multiple tons. Or they can sit on benchtop and do a few grams to a couple of pounds. It just depends on what you're going to test. If for structural adhesive bonding, probably something that can handle about 10,000 pounds or 4,500 kilograms. That should encompass the vast majority of routine sample testing with adhesives, and also most plastics, by the way, or composites. If you get into larger structures that you think you're going to be trying to tear apart or push apart, then you're going to have to go into heavier frames and heavier load cells. But for routine testing of adhesives work in a lab, like 10,000 pounds is adequate. If you're going to be getting into environmental exposure, a good temperature humidity cabinet is quite useful. I mentioned before, you can do temperature, you can do humidity. There are cabinets that do both, and they will cycle. And you can get a fair number of samples in there. So a temperature humidity cabinet, or ovens, freezers, and some type of humidity testing is a good idea. The thing to remember about ovens, for example, is, again, that they're going to be in use for quite a while. So if you think you're going to be doing a lot of hot soaks, then you probably want to buy a dedicated oven or ovens, so you're not tying up the lab oven or ovens for weeks. You definitely want to buy separate ovens for those kinds of soaks. And they don't have to be highly sophisticated, because you're just going to set the temperature and leave it. So that's another thing. And then also freezers, either a chest freezer or small or whatnot. And that can be useful if you're going to do exposure to cold. The thing with freezers is any freezer will do zero. your kitchen freezer does 0 F. A lot of tests are minus 40. And so for minus 40, you know, your standard head down to the appliance store freezer is not going to work. You'll have to buy a lab freezer that'll go down that cold and that sort of thing. So to recap that part of it, you want a tensile tester, maybe some ovens or freezers, and then you decide what you think you need to do with humidity exposure.
Well, George, thanks again so much for sharing your insights with us today.
Well, thank you. I imagine there'll be questions which they can go to you, I'm guessing, and can work their way to me.
Absolutely.
So I hope this was helpful for people. Again, testing is a wide arena, and there's some art to it. But I hope I've helped to strip off some of the mask anyway as to what you can do or what you should look forward to doing.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks also to our listeners for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more, go to adhesivesmag.com and read George's column. It's called What Tests Should I Run on My Structural Adhesive Systems? Or you can visit ChemQuest.com.